Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. Damascus is calling a Turkish military operation overnight to evacuate dozens of troops and relocate a historically significant tomb in northern Syria, an act of flagrant aggression. Ankara dispatched soldiers, tanks and jets over the border to rescue nearly 40 Turkish soldiers tasked with protecting the remains of Suleiman Shah, grandfather of Ottoman Empire founder. As Islamic State militants were closing in, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
Hundreds of soldiers, supported by nearly 100 tanks and armored vehicles, along with fighter jets, traveled nearly 30 kilometers into Syria, but no clashes were reported. The forces returned to Turkish territory Sunday. One soldier died in what was described as an accident. He said Turkish forces took control of an area of Syria, raising the Turkish flag, where Suleiman Shah will later be transferred. Under a 1921 treaty with Syria, Turkey claims a small part of Syrian territory for a mausoleum for Suleiman Shah, which is protected by Turkish soldiers. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Secretary of State John Kerry and his Iranian counterpart are meeting in Switzerland today as they continue to try to reach a deal on Iran's nuclear program by March 31st. Kerry and Mohammad Javad Zarif join talks already underway with Iran's atomic energy chief Ali Akbar Saleh and U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz. The discussions between the U.S. and Iran are aimed at resolving disputes blocking an agreement between Iran and the six world powers known as the P5+1. Nigeria's military says it has reclaimed a strategic border town from the Boko Haram militant group. A military spokesman said the government troops, backed by airstrikes, took control of Baga after a fierce battle late Friday. This is VOA News. Two people were killed today when a bomb exploded in the Ukrainian city of Kharkiv as government supporters there and elsewhere marked the one-year anniversary of the overthrow of the country's pro-Kremlin president, Viktor Yanukovych. Authorities said at least 10 other people were injured by the blast during a march commemorating Mr. Yanukovych's ouster. Kharkiv is more than 200 kilometers from the front line where pro-Russian separatists have been battling Kiev's forces, but rebels have carried out violent protests in eastern Ukraine's biggest city during the past year. Meantime, military officials say both sides have agreed to pull back heavy weapons from eastern Ukraine, a positive sign for the implementation of a peace deal that has been repeatedly violated. The rebels have now confirmed through news organizations that they have signed the deal, which calls for withdrawal in the next 2 weeks. Australia's government plans to monitor social media in real time to try to combat terrorist propaganda on the internet. The government hopes the effort will help identify and dismantle online messages of hate from groups such as the Islamic State. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Attorney General George Brandis says the scheme to monitor social media would help thwart extremists who use the internet to weaponize information.
We are monitoring social media for the purpose of identifying and, where appropriate, taking down terrorist propaganda.
The plan would need the support of internet service providers and companies such as Google and Facebook to trawl social media looking for offensive posts and videos. David Connery from the Australian Strategic Policy Institute says targeting the right people won't be easy.
The idea of a counter-narrative has been discussed for some time, but what I think they're trying to do is add to the government's overall disruption strategy towards terrorism.
Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
New U.S. Defense Secretary Ashton Carter is in southern Afghanistan today reviewing plans to withdraw U.S. troops from the country within 2 years. On his second day in Afghanistan, Carter flew from Kabul to Kandahar for more meetings with Afghan leaders and American military commanders. He also met with Afghan President Ashraf Ghani.
The grounds for peace have never been better in the last 36 years. Our approach is productive. We are hopeful that categorical answers in a peace process are dangerous. The questions are under consideration. The direction is positive. We cannot make premature announcements.
Mr. Ghani talking there about prospects for peace with the Taliban. This is Carter's first trip abroad since becoming the U.S. Defense Secretary. And gunmen have raided a South Sudanese school, kidnapping at least 89 children, according to the United Nations. The abduction took place while students were taking exams in a school near Malakal, and the number could be even higher. The militants went house to house. I'm Marty Johnson reporting.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Going by the list of distributed voters' cards nationwide, the APC stood to lose.
Nigerian incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan faces a stiff challenge from main opposition leader Muhammadu Buhari in the March 28th general election.
We are going today to start negotiations on the outstanding issues which we left in the Rainbow Document.
A top South Sudan official worries that the split among rebels loyal to Riek Machar could derail peace talks in Addis Ababa.
Always the poor and the smaller are the most vulnerable. Starting from the fact that they are already in marginal areas.
And Paris opens its yearly International Agricultural Show. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, a female suicide bomber killed at least five people and wounded dozens at a security checkpoint outside a market in Potiskum, a town in the northeastern part of that country today. Gambo Barao is a resident of Potiskum where the blast occurred. He joins us live from the area via telephone link up. Good evening, Mr. Barao.
Hello, how are you, sir?
I'm well, thank you very much, Mr. Barao. Now, Gambo, tell me, what did you experience today at the market?
Yeah, it is around 1 o'clock in the afternoon this Sunday when our people went to mosque and they are coming back from mosque. One again come to the handset seller market. She tried to enter the market. The watchman stopped her, and in that processing time, she blew the pump. And that very recent time, five people died and about 20 people get injured.
Now, Mr. Barao, is this a handset market for telephones?
Yeah, handset market. Oh, no. Where they sell handsets.
Now, what has authorities, including the governor, state government officials, have they said anything about what occurred today about the suicide bombing?
As of now, the government didn't say anything, but we are expecting them to say something.
So how are people reacting to this latest development about the suicide bombing in Potiskum?
As I told you this thing, many people didn't hear this town of the bomb, and the business is still carried on. Everybody is doing business, but only the place that bomb blow is people afraid.
Now, are they expressing concern that there could be possible attack from Boko Haram again due to this latest attack from this suicide bombing today?
Since the time that bomb blow for the first 3 to 4 months back, they cleared the place and they keep watching nobody enter without touching, and they got that touch robot. When you will enter, they will touch you. Even you are a soldier or somebody else.
So security is pretty much improved at the market in other places in Potiskum. Is that what you're saying?
I said if security people went to the market, they will be touched before they enter the market.
So the people at the market, including yourself, are safe to sell your wares at the market?
That's what I'm trying to say.
Now, so the people who have been injured, have they been taken to the hospital at the moment?
since they are in hospital, they have been given treatment.
Has officials gone there to see them, and have they come to the market to inspect, and has investigation begun?
And the chairman come to the hospital and see the patients, people.
Now, I learned that a lot of people went to pray. Is that what happened, and that is why there weren't that many casualties?
No. If to say, when the time of prayer, we get many people casualty, but at the time she went there, many people not there. They went for prayer.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
That was Gambo Barawe, a resident of Potiskum, where the suicide bomb blast occurred this afternoon in Nigeria. He joined us live from Potiskum in northeastern Nigeria. Still in Nigeria, Nigerian political parties have stepped up their campaigns in the run-up to the March 28th election. Incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan faces a stiff challenge from General Muhammadu Buhari of the opposition All Progressives Congress, or APC. Aid Igwabo, a Nigerian journalist and social commentator, was in the VOA studios here in Washington, D.C. I asked him how prospective Nigerian voters received the news of the postponement of the originally planned February 14 election.
Initially, it was some kind of mixed feelings because certain the issues had largely been politicized. But with the revelations that came about in the following days, Nigerians have begun to think that INEC was really not ready to conduct the February 14th elections.
People were of the view that since the election is going to be competitive, all polls indicating that, they think that pressure was brought bare on the Electoral Commission because they fear President Jonathan might lose the election, and that is why they're politicizing this to give them some amount of leg room to commit whatever shenanigans the speculation is. Do you think those criticisms are justified?
The truth of the matter is that going by the list of distributed voters' cards nationwide, the APC stood to lose because Kano and Lagos are where you have the highest number of registered voters. That being so, 35%, only 35% of persons had collected their voters' cards in Lagos, and a little over 60% in Kano. If it was in the interest of the PDP to go to, or the president to go to elections, clearly, because a lot more people were being disenfranchised in the two states that are under the control of the APC. But the truth really is that this matter, you have to look at it dispassionately. How could it be, for instance, that Lagos had only 35% voters' cards collected, and Maiduguri, Borno State rather, had 79%?
Let me ask you this question. There appeared to be a refocus on Boko Haram all of a sudden within 6 weeks of the election, when Nigerians themselves said that Boko Haram has been causing mayhem for the last 6 or so years. Why, all of a sudden, election is at the door, there's a refocus? How do you justify that?
You see, to understand this issue thoroughly, you must look back to the military days, and it is on record that since 1983, when Buhari came to power, the civilian regime of Shagari was the only one that equipped the army, that purchased arms and ammunition, that tended to address the issues of military needs, and for selfish reasons, because every subsequent military regime that came to power tried to reduce the possibility of a coup against it. Mm-hmm. And therefore, the military was left to wallow for decades. Buhari was head of state. Ask him how many helicopters he bought for the Air Force. Ask him how many tanks he bought for the army.
Okay.
And therefore, until this issue of Boko Haram really, really became a potential source of security threat, President Jonathan then started to look around. And of course, you are aware of the politics of America refusing to sell arms, and Israel and several other places. And it is only now arms are not bought across the shelf. You have to build your, make your orders to specification. It takes a period of time to have them delivered. And the truth of the matter is that the Nigerian armed forces are only just taking delivery of the weapons that were ordered by this same government. I mean, even if there were going to be a coalition of forces, they won't come with their tanks and guns and what have you from their various countries. The country that is concerned must provide arms, equipment, and support services for them to be able to fight.
Now, do you think this election will be credible, transparent, and devoid of violence? And the opposition, obviously, is saying that the PDP seem to want to undermine the credibility of the election and win by hook or crook. Even the former head of the PDP, Chief Olusegun Obasanjo, the former president, is on record to say that the PDP wants to win the election by hook or crook.
Well, I don't want to go into the politics of what Obasanjo has said or not said. Time will soon tell who, what character of a man he is. But these elections will not only be credible, will not only be acceptable, it would also be violent-free.
Aide Igwabo is a Nigerian journalist and social commentator. He spoke with me from here in the nation's capital. Meanwhile, Nigeria says it will begin enforcing a 2012 law which bans oil flaring as part of the government's effort to protect the environment. The law imposes stiff penalties, including fines on companies engaged in flaring. But Pioneer Energy, a U.S.-based company, has developed a technology to capture the flared gas for power generation and for domestic use. Eyal Aronoff, the head of Pioneer Energy, told me that the company wants to help Nigeria recover lost revenue from the flared gas.
Pioneer Energy, the company that I'm involved with, have a solution to capture the flared gas directly from the flare itself and separate from that flare and create two products. One is natural gas that can be used for power generation, and the other is propane, which could be used as fuel for cooking.
So how significant is this in relation to the law?
Well, natural gas in Nigeria has been flared since a very long time. And Nigeria is second to only Russia in global flaring. The country flares about 530 billion cubic feet of natural gas. That number is from 2010. So the loss of opportunity for Nigeria is about $2.5 billion a year, according to the EIA. With our solution, the country will be able to capture this flared gas and actually convert it into usable products, both for power generation and to supply the local market with cooking fuel.
How beneficial will this be? And have you approached the government to resolve this important challenge that you spoke about?
See, part of the problem that Nigeria has is it's very difficult to build all the huge infrastructure that is required in order to put the pipes and everything that is needed to capture the gas. Our solution enables, we have this transportable device that comes to your wellhead, and you put it right there at the well site, and you can capture the gas right there rather than flare it and separate it into these liquids that you can then ship by truck to market. And we are now in the first stages of discussions with the Nigerian government on that solution.
Is there a market for the captured gas using your technology, and how do you intend to use it specifically in Nigeria, i.e. in power generation and for cooking purposes?
So our solution does not address that part. This we only give an enabling technology that enables the producers, the oil producers, to overcome the very large amount of investment that otherwise would be required in order to capture the gas in a central way. Because we provide localized solution that you can capture the gas in small scale. Okay, but once you capture the gas, then these companies have the wherewithal to, market the product just like they market today their oil.
What do you see as the prospects of this technology in Nigeria to help the people?
I think with the growing population of Nigeria and the growing wealth of the population, growing middle class, we are seeing both shortage in electricity and capacity as well as in cooking fuel, and particularly in rural areas. And our technology can be deployed in rural areas and provide the local population in the rural areas both power, electricity, as well as cooking gas, and to some extent transportation fuel, because you can convert a car to run on propane. So we believe that our solution will really help in urban development and in rural development.
Apart from Nigeria, other African countries produce oil. How will this transfer of technology reach those areas apart from Nigeria?
Yes, correct. So, oil production in Africa is really growing leaps and bounds. But what's not growing in Nigeria is the use, in Africa, is the use of natural gas and the natural gas resources that are available in Africa. As a result, a lot of this gas is being flared. What we are proposing with our solution is, yes, the countries will produce oil, and most of this oil will end up going to export to bring hard dollars in. But they could also utilize the gas with our technology to prop up the local economies and to provide service and solutions for the population in the country. So it's a win for everybody.
Eyal Aronoff is the head of the U.S.-based Pioneer Energy. He spoke with me from Los Angeles, California. A top South Sudanese government spokesman who is attending the peace talks with rebels in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, says a recent defection from rebel leader Riek Machar's negotiating team could derail the talks. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA from South Sudanese capital, Juba.
South Sudan's information minister, Michael Makwei, apparently was referring to a recent announcement by Brigadier General Lulu Roy Kwong, the former military spokesman for South Sudan's anti opposition, saying he was defecting from the group to conclude that the rebel faction's ranks are beginning to splinter.
There is a split already in the rebel ranks. And this split may have an effect in a way or the other on the peace talks.
Makwe says the split is likely to derail the talks.
Upon our arrival, we need to know with whom are we going to negotiate. There are already two factions, and these two factions are there. And as such, we will not just go and start talking, but we will go and talk with the rebels when they have put their house in order.
Brigadier General Kwong announced his defection from rebel forces on Wednesday and said he was establishing a different faction. However, he has not appeared at the talks with any new faction. The talks are scheduled to get underway in Anesti over the weekend and are expected to result in a comprehensive peace agreement to end a 14-month-long conflict in South Sudan. President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar met last month in Addis Ababa, where they signed a framework agreement which the two sides say should pave the way for reaching a comprehensive peace agreement. Makwe questions many issues have yet to be resolved.
We are going today to start negotiations on the outstanding issues which we left in the Rainbow Document. So we are going to discuss issues of structures, issues of the establishment and the composition of the government of national unity, and issues of federalism, issues of security arrangements and economic arrangements.
Makwe says the hope is to strike a deal by the IGAD imposed March 5th deadline. The off-again, on-again talks have continued for more than a year with little progress to show for them. Makwe says despite a recommitment to a cessation of hostilities agreement, fighting continues in Upper Nile State, and he accused the rebels of launching those attacks.
It is since last week that the rebels continued attacking our positions in western Upper Nile, that is in the area of Haluf, in the area of Kaka, in the area of Reng in northern Upper Nile. Even this morning, they attack our positions in Nasir. But nevertheless, all these attacks, all these violations will not change the position of the government in search of peace.
The two sides are slated to announce a transitional government of national unity by April of this year. It remains to be seen whether that will happen. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wodo in Juba.
Paris has opened its yearly international agricultural show, an event packed with farm animals, growers and excited children. But this year's show also highlights the devastating effect of climate change on farm production ahead of a major climate summit in Paris later this year. Farmers and experts from around the world met in the French capital Friday to discuss ways to adapt agriculture to a more difficult and uncertain future. Reporter Lisa Brand has more for VOA from Paris.
Bigger droughts, more frequent flooding, more devastating storms. These are just some of the effects that climate change is already having on our planet. And farmers, many of them small family growers in developing countries, are on the front lines. These farmers will also have to feed a world population that's expected to climb from just over 7 billion today to about 9.6 billion in 2050. For United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization Director General Jose Graziano da Silva, agriculture must become more sustainable, more resilient, and more inclusive to respond to climate change and to ensure that the poorest people have access to food.
Always the poorest and the smallest are the most vulnerable, starting from the fact that they are already in marginal areas. So they are the first that are affected by a drought or by a flooding. That are the, let's say, the current ongoing impacts of the climate change.
The FAO chief spoke at an international meeting in Paris looking at the impact and solutions when it comes to climate change and agriculture. The city hosts a major UN climate conference in December intended to reach an international deal to cut greenhouse gas emissions.
Il y a aussi l'enjeu de la conférence de Paris.
At the agricultural meeting, French President François Hollande said the UN summit will not solve all the climate change problems, but it must at least give the world a reason for hope. It's important to define a global strategy to fight climate change, he said, and agriculture must be part of the solution. Evelyn Nguleka of Zambia is president of the World Farmers Organization. She told VOA that farmers are looking for practical solutions.
Because it is one thing just to send an alarm that there is going to be weather pattern changes. But what is important for the farmer is how is a farmer going to be able to survive? So resilience for us is a key word. And of course, that goes with innovations.
Nadjiru Sall from northern Senegal heads a West African farmers organization called ROPA. He said the Sahel region where he lives has been dealing with longer droughts for several decades.
Moi, je suis dans l'agriculture familiale. Je suis sur un pays sahélien.
Sal said the Paris Climate Conference will be useful if it takes the problems of family farmers like himself into account. If not, as far as he's concerned, it will be a failure. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza is bidding for a third term in June's election. We'll discuss why the move is stirring controversy. That's next time on VOA Africa.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's go to Nigeria and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, February 22nd. Algerian football club Entente Sétif has won the African Super Cup. Entente Sétif became the first Algerian club to win the Super Cup after beating Egyptian giant Al Ahly in a dramatic penalty shootout on Saturday in Blida, Algeria. The one-off match between the African Champions League and the CAF Confederation Cup winners ended in a dramatic fashion as Emad Mutiab scored 4 minutes into stoppage time to equalize 1-1 for Al Ahly. But Sétif survived the nail-biting finale to triumph 6-5 on penalties, converting all of its kicks before fullback Bassem Ali missed for Ali. Sétif, winner of the 2014 Champions League on the away goals rule, had taken the lead at the Mustapha Cheka Stadium after 70 minutes through Abdelmalik Ziaya. Ali is a six-time winner of the CAF Super Cup, including the last two editions. It was the first time since 1994 that Ali has tasted defeat in the CAF Super Cup. 21 years ago, the Red Devils lost to bitter rival Zamalek in the 1994 edition held in Johannesburg, South Africa. CAF President Issa Hayatou, assisted by Algerian Minister of Youth and Sports Mohamed Tami, presented the giant trophy to ES Sétif captain Melouli amid cheers from the ecstatic crowd. In addition to the trophy, the Black Eagles, as ES Sétif is known, also got $75,000 in cash prize. Reacting to the victory, ES Sétif coach Kredim Madoui hailed his club's triumph, saying it was at the better side of luck. Madoui, who has joined the rare list of coaches to have won both the CAF Champions League and the CAF Super Cup, said, "I'm proud to win this title. Ali gave us problems, but that did not stop us from believing. It was a tough match against a strong opponent. We know penalties depend hugely on luck, and we were lucky in the end." The coach hailed goalkeeper Kedaria, calling him the ES Sétif's savior. With the CAF Super Cup taking the club's trophy haul to 23 titles, Madoui finally declared that ES Sétif has now joined the elite class of African football. Reacting to his team's loss, Al Ahly coach Juan Carlos Garrido absolved his players of blame. "We were better in almost all aspects of the game, made good passes, and better in possession. Even when we were behind, we came back strongly and equalized," Garrido said at the post-match press conference. "We missed many chances that could have secured the match for us. ES Sétif's goal was by chance. I cannot blame my players. They did a great job," the Spaniard added. Away from African club football, Nigeria and Guinea are through to the semi-finals of the ongoing 2015 CAF Under-17 Football Championship in the West African nation of Niger. Both teams qualified after finishing first and second respectively, as Group A action was concluded on Saturday. Nigeria beat Zambia 3-1 at State Municipal in the capital city of Niamey to finish on 7 points and grab the group's top spot. Host Niger handed Guinea a 2-1 defeat at the State Seni Kunche, also in the capital. But the 4 points collected in the first two group games were enough to see the silly national juniors into the next stage. Host Niger as well as Zambia finished on 3 points each and were eliminated from the tournament for future African football stars. For reaching the semi-finals of the tournament, both Nigeria and Guinea have also secured places at the FIFA Under-17 World Cup Finals to be held in Chile in October. The two semi-finalists from Group B will also qualify to fly the African flag at the Global Under-17 tournament. In other news, the black Frenchman who was the victim of racist abuse by Chelsea football fans on the Paris Metro has received a personal message from President Francois Hollande. The president took the unusual step of speaking to Suleiman on the telephone on Friday to express his sympathy over his ordeal. The president spoke to Suleiman and offered his support over the odious racial attack he suffered. The presidency announced on his Twitter account. Suleiman S., a French Mauritanian, was blocked from boarding a train by fans traveling for the match against Paris Saint-Germain in the Champions League, which ended 1-1 on Tuesday. Footage captured by a bystander appears to show him being pushed back onto the platform. Amid chants of, we are racist, and that's the way we like it. Chelsea has condemned the attack and has suspended a total of 5 people from attending matches at the club's Stamford Bridge ground with the potential of live bans. Finally, Ethiopian runners Endesho Negese and Bahani Dibaba won the men's and women's titles today, Sunday, at the 2015 Tokyo Marathon, with Africans dominating the top 10 in both categories. Negese won the men's race in 2 hours and 6 minutes, while Dibaba clocked 2 hours, 23 minutes and 15 seconds to win the women's title. It was the first time that runners from the same nation had won both the men's and women's titles in the 9-year history of the event. Negese broke away from Kenya's defending champion Dickson Chumba just before the 40-kilometer mark to become only the second Ethiopian man after Haile Mekonnen in 2011 to win Japan's most prestigious road race. It was the third fastest time in Tokyo Marathon, but just fell short of the twin goals of beating the Japanese all-comers best of 2 hours, 5 minutes and 18 seconds, and the course record of 2 hours, 5 minutes and 48 seconds, set by Chumba in 2014. For her part, Dibaba won the women's title despite her late arrival in Tokyo due to transport problems. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
I've been thinking of you.
Make we day like bread and butter, cause I know we'll be together. You didn't make me higher, one more get you hot like fire. Ne, I know go retire.
Hey, hey, biko ala kukwa namu, nde ara kutanamu. Ife nini cholo, nge nyeti anu juu.
Of you are they fly like butterfly, my love, my love. Now this thing make people they say, I don't lose my sense, my pain, but nobody can stop me from loving you. I'm with you, my lover, lover. With you, everything is well, well, your love, they make my heart to do yori yori. Nobody can love you the way I do. I'm with you, my lover, lover. With you, everything is well, well, your love, they make my heart to do yori yori. Nobody can love you the way I do. I'm with you. My love, you see the way all the things they flow. So I'm surprised to see how they love you so. Girl, I just suspect, say them no, no. Say that you be the person where they make me flow. Ooh, I tell them, say you are the blessing. And that's why you are so interesting. Nobody's understanding the way you are. Oh, my beautiful girl. Now all things make people they say. I don't lose my sense, my pain. But they can't stop me from loving you. I'm with you, my love, love. Love, they affect my brain. Until you, they make me go insane. It go make sense if you come my place. If you know here, I'm I go talk I'm again. Your love, they affect my brain. Oh, my love, how they go insane. Just leave him the way he be, the way he tease. Oh, my love. Now all these make people, they say, I don't lose my sense, my brain. But they can't stop me from loving you. I'm waiting, my love, love. Well, well, your love, they make my heart to do yori yori. Nobody can love you the way I do. I'm with you, my love, love. With you, everything is well, well, your love, they make my heart to do yori yori. Nobody can love you the way I do. I'm with you, my love, love. I'm with you, my love.
when you really love me, make my heart to do yori yori. Nobody can love you the way I do. I'm with you, my love, love. With you, everything is well, well. You love me, make my heart to do yori yori. Nobody can love you the way I do. I'm with you, my love, love. Yeah, yeah, yori, yori, yeah, yeah, yori. They come zile, I die. My love, love. My love, love, ooh, my love, love, nobody can stop me from loving you. I'm with you, my love, love.
Hey! Mr. Flavor Bunny Dance!
Baby, na tomato just you. Adama, she too simple, she too humble. What I know, I'm a man of sorrow. Adama, you be my choice, yo.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. It is understandable that the African Union, AU, may be hesitant to bring succor to the cauldron that is now Libya, a failed state if there is one. At the height of the six-month uprising in Libya in 2011, that some called the Libyan Revolution, when it appeared likely that there would be an armed blood clash between Colonel Gaddafi and his opponents, the AU presented a balanced, sensible roadmap for a peaceful resolution of the crisis. But those whose main goal was to execute a regime change plan encouraged Gaddafi's opponents to reject the AU's plan on the grounds that it did not eliminate the continuation of Gaddafi's 42-year-old rule. The false narrative then was that the so-called Arab Spring requires a new beginning and democratic dispensation, which could not allow the participation of an autocrat like Gaddafi. With the passage of time and the evidence now available to the international community, one wonders who coined the term Arab Spring. Definitely, it did not originate from Africa or the Arab countries. What is certain is that the concept is not a product of robust analytical capability. Apart from the progress made in Tunisia, the so-called Arab Spring has brought nothing but chaos and disaster to the countries affected. But even in Tunisia, it could not be confidently asserted that the progress made was due to the Arab Spring. The fact of the matter is that the new elected president, Deji Kaid Selby, is an 88-year-old man who served as interior minister under Tunisia's first president after independence in 1956, Habib Bourguiba. He defeated Mr. Marzouki, who campaigned for the revolution. It does seem possible that the democratic election was searching for someone to foster stability. As far as Libya goes, utter turmoil now prevails. Even those that carried out the regime change and had hoped to profit from Libya's oil are not anxious to get involved. The United Nations is now endeavoring to promote a peaceful settlement, but it is unlikely that it could succeed. Last week, it turned out that ISIS has managed to join forces with one of the many armed groups in Libya and did carry out a dastardly act when it slaughtered 21 Egyptian Coptic Christians. In retaliation, Egypt commenced bombing of ISIS targets in Libya. Egypt's appeal of greater United Nations involvement has been rejected. Instead, one of the Libyan governments that recognized by the UN has requested the lifting of the arms embargo against the country. Certainly, the presence of ISIS in Libya has greatly complicated matters. In the circumstances, it may require the African Union to explore how best to contribute to a peaceful resolution of the crisis in Libya. Thus far, the disputing parties have used force of arms to settle their dispute. But this is not a productive exercise, nor will it be an easy matter for the disputants to engage in a peaceful settlement. The African Union is to find a willing interlocutor, and possibly it may want to start with Egypt. At this stage, the Egyptian government is under severe pressure from its population to act and act promptly against ISIS in Libya. This may not help matters. Perhaps it is a vain hope that powerful states will take Libya as a good example. It is easier to intervene to change governments, but it is quite difficult to find stability. What they should do now is to keep in mind the well-known pottery barn rule. You break it and you own it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, sports editor Segun Ademi, and our engineer for today, Brian Makulie, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, quality beats do not rattle. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Despite the horrors taking place in Syria, with civilians victimized by both the Assad regime and by violent extremists like ISIL, members of Syria's civil society still work to deliver essential services, coordinate humanitarian relief, rescue the wounded, document abuses, and lay the groundwork for a political transition. Earlier this month, U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Tom Malinowski traveled to Turkey to meet with members of Syria's civil society and opposition to express the U.S. government's support for their work. He underscored U.S. support for Syrian human rights defenders and media activists and reiterated deep concern for the thousands of political prisoners who must be released, including human rights lawyers Mazen Darwish and Razan Zeytune. He also stressed that the Syrian people deserve justice, the ability to freely choose their government, and relief from the Assad regime's barrel bombs and other horrific abuses. He and the activists he met with condemned the murders and brutality committed by both the Assad regime and ISIL. Assad's brutality, in the form of barrel bombs and airstrikes, tragically continued this month in both the Damascus suburbs of eastern Ghouta and Douma, where hundreds of civilians, including children, were killed and wounded, and in Aleppo, where Assad's air force dropped barrel bombs in the public square when civilians were collecting water and waiting for buses. State Department Deputy Spokesperson Marie Harf condemned the bombings, saying they show an utter disregard for human life, and noted that Syrians on the ground report these are among the Assad regime's most brutal attacks since its unrelenting campaign of terror began nearly 4 years ago. They are examples of the countless atrocities committed by the Assad regime against the Syrian people, she said, and reaffirm there can never be a stable, inclusive Syria under the leadership of this ruthless dictator. In his meeting with Syrian activists in Turkey, Assistant Secretary Tom Malinowski noted that it was the Assad regime's brutal suppression of democratic opposition forces and atrocities against civilians that allowed terrorist groups like ISIL to grow. The United States, he said, stands with Syria's brave activists who, despite grave threats, continue their efforts to achieve fundamental human rights for all Syrians.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.